ARUP acknowledges the traditional owners across all lands, waters and skies the firm may reach. We acknowledge their wisdom, resilience and rich cultural heritage. We pay our respects to the elders past and present, and to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. We recognise the ongoing journey of healing and reconciliation, and ARUP commits to walking alongside First Nations peoples to acknowledge their teachings and foster a future of unity and respect. Welcome to ARUP's podcast, Sustainable Forces, a podcast about people joining forces to help solve some of the most complex sustainable development challenges. I'm your host, Dr. Michelle Dickinson, and today we're talking about active transport, walking, cycling, and other human-powered ways of getting around. It's not only good for our health and the environment, but also plays a crucial role in how we connect with each other and move through our cities. But here's the catch. Active transport systems are often designed with a narrow focus, leaving many people, including women, children, gender-diverse individuals, people with disabilities, and marginalized communities, feeling excluded or unsafe. Safety, accessibility, and comfort can look very different depending on who you are. So what would it take to create truly inclusive active transport systems that work for everyone? In fact, how active and inclusive is your city's transport? This is a question I asked Hank Swarto, President of the European Cyclist Federation, and Dr. Sara Candarici, Associate Director at ARUP Cities Planning and Design Team in Milan, and Global Leader for Social Value and Equity. Together, we unpacked global case studies, shared strategies, and explored how we can design cities where active transport empowers all communities. Here's my conversation with Hank and Sara. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Hi, Hank. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining us all the way from Amsterdam today. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and about your role at the European Cyclist Federation, please?
Hello, Michelle. Thank you for having me on the podcast. My name is Hank Swarto. I'm president of the European Cyclist Federation. But before I got into cycling, I've been a professional diplomat in the Dutch Foreign Service for more than 30 years. And actually, it's through diplomacy that I ended up where I'm now, because when I was Dutch ambassador to Finland, the local cycling activists, well, wanted me, coming from a cycling country, to help them improve cycling in Finland. So the European Cyclist Federation is like an umbrella organization of civil society organizations all over Europe and some outside Europe, which work for more and better cycling for all. That's lobbying at the European institutions in Brussels, at the European Commission, giving instruments to our members so they can lobby their own governments or local authorities. We organize the annual World Cycling Congress, VeloCity. We coordinate the European Long Distance Cycling Network, Eurovelo. So that's what I'm doing. Actually, we are still the European Cyclist Federation, but we're working on becoming the International Cyclist Federation with a global remit.
Amazing. Incredible. And Sara, welcome, friend. Thank you for joining us from Milan. Could you also share with us some insights about you and your role at ARUP?
Yeah, thank you. And thanks also, Hank, for joining us. For joining this podcast. So I'm Sara Candarici. I'm an urban planner and social scientist as background. At ARUP, I'm an associate director of the city plan design team. I'm based in Milan. And I also lead our global work on social value and equity. And basically, my work involves conducting quite a lot of applied research, policy and technical advisory work. And I also work a lot on project design and implementation across the globe, from Europe, the Middle East, Asia, and also quite a lot of work in Africa. So basically, as social value lead at ARUP, my focus is to try to ensure that our projects, which can, you know, range from master planning to transport system planning or designing of building, basically that they are designed for everyone. and actually they truly serve the needs of diverse populations, looking at different age groups, looking at different genders and abilities. And before joining AROP, I worked for more than 15 years with the UN, in particular with UN Habitat, many years in Africa, and also with development banks like the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank, and always trying to bring on board the voices and the point of view of underrepresented communities and marginalized groups in urban planning and design.
Amazing. Thank you. And we will go back into your history soon and how that has helped you to do what we're talking about today. So let's talk about transport systems. Now, we know that they're integral for every city. And anybody who's traveled anywhere knows that every city you go to has a different transport system. They look different all over the world. And today we're going to reflect on how inclusive they are and how well they empower people to get around their city in both an active and a safe way. So, Henk, I know you're passionate about this. We're going to start with you. What do you think makes an inclusive and an active transport system? And how does what you think about this inform your work at the European Cyclist Network?
Well, an active the easiest one is an active transport system, which is a transport system that promotes and facilitates active transport modes, that is cycling and walking. Cycling, in this case, including according to us, e-bikes, as long as you need to contribute muscle power to produce locomotion. So scooters would not qualify as an active mode in that definition. So promoting active modes, it's the most important aspect is safety, road safety. The most important reason why people do not cycle to work, to school, doing shopping, is that they perceive roads as unsafe to cyclists. Now, there are several ways to improve that. One is, of course, a good quality separate infrastructure for cycling, for walking, making space for those modes. That's the technical, the hardware side, and then there's the software side. That's actually legislation. What proves to be a very effective measure is lowering maximum speeds in cities to 30 kilometers or 20 miles per hour. Another very effective measure is in a number of countries, when there is a crash between a motor vehicle and a cyclist or a pedestrian, it's always the motor vehicle or the driver of the motor vehicle, rather, who is in the wrong. So there's a presumption of innocence for the pedestrian or for the cyclist. So it's a combination of policies, technical measures, legislation, and then what is often forgotten also, culture. Cycling is being perceived very different across the world. There are still countries where when you cycle, it's stigmatized because it means you cannot afford anything better. Whereas, of course, we would assume that cycling is the better way. But there is still a deeply ingrained perception that that private car ownership is the top of the pyramid. Walking is the bottom, and the rest is in between. But there are also countries, there's this wonderful meme out there, a picture of Paul McCartney on a train, that the best country in the world is where the rich people use public transport.
Yeah, very thought-provoking. I'd love to know what your triangle would look like, but not yet, because Sarah, I'm interested in your thoughts. What do you believe makes an inclusive and an active transport system? And can you talk a little bit about some of the examples that you have seen in your work around this?
Yeah, no, I think, Henk already provided a kind of good overview of key principles to take into account to ensure that transport systems are active. Maybe looking at also the inclusivity aspect of transport systems. So it's very important that they are accessible, and not only from a physical point of view, but from like an economic point of view, so that public transport that promote biking and cycling also provides infrastructure that are accessible, services that are accessible for everyone. And also that consider equity in the design. So making sure that they are designed the systems looking at the needs of different groups in the society. For instance, children or elderly people or women with small kids or women alone. So looking at the safety point of view, but from the lens of these users. Also maybe to make it inclusive, it's very important that walking and cycling is also integrated within the kind of broader transit system so that they are well connected to other, like, the, I don't know, the bus, the train station, the metro station, so that walking and cycling are looked within the bigger kind of system. And then, as Hank said, cultural norms or what I call kind of behavior, social behavior is very important because it's perceived in differently from different culture. Or sometimes cycling is kind of seen, like in Africa where I work, is seen as something that only low income people do. If you are wealthy, you buy a car. So it's this kind of behavior change are required. So policies, programs, awareness creation campaign are also very important. So we try to adopt these principles across our projects. An example is the application of the Proximity of Care Design Guide, which is basically a design guide we developed with the Van Leer Foundation, which is a Dutch foundation looking at the needs of young children, their caregivers. And this is basically a guide that looks at how to create child and family friendly urban environments. And many of these principles are embedded in the guide. And we applied this in several cities across the globe, quite a lot in Latin America. We work with organization like Espacio Ludico, Ciudad de Nueva Gente, Estudio Maisum. We work in Uruguay, in Chile, and in Brazil to make sure that the urban spaces and the mobility options for, in particular for children and their families, are really designed and tailored to their needs. So by looking at how to widen sidewalks, how to improve crossing in front of the school, how to integrate a green space and natural elements into the design. And we saw that by creating this space, we're not only, and also mobility options, we're not only improving safety for children, actually we are creating an environment that supports the well-being of the wider community. Another example, another model that is quite well known across the globe is the 15-minute city model, which has transformed Paris over the past few years, I must say, and reducing dramatically not only road accidents, but also improving air quality, so reducing air pollution. And as we all know, it's about improving access to services, to facilities, to workplaces, and so improving, reducing car dependency. At the same time, I think it's very important, because there are many cities which are embracing this model, which I think is great, but we need to be a bit careful, I think, when we look at the 15-minute city approach. Because in many cases, the way it is success is measured is in relation to accessibility. Like walkability is measured in terms of accessing services, but not like actually looking at the quality of the experience. For instance, I live in Milan. I moved here a couple of years ago, and Milan was recently ranked as the most walkable city in the world. When I read the news, say, okay, so why? I was a bit confused, and because it is true that the infrastructure and the public transport options are great, are efficient, but when I walk in Milan, I'm not happy because the sidewalks are narrow. Well, they're not accessible for people with limited mobility, which is not my case. But looking around, there are not so many elderly people walking around or people with disabilities. So, and then there are far too many cars park everywhere, and the air pollution is quite high. So when I read that news, I was happy for the city. At the same time, I was confused because so it's me who has I'm over-criticizing, you know, the city. But then looking at other people, they also felt a bit puzzled when they saw the news, because, and maybe this is kind of highlighting an important reflection that, yeah, walkability isn't just about proximity to service, but actually is the experience of it, how to you feel connected with the space. Are you feeling happy where you walk? Do you feel safe? So it's really about how cities make people feel. And so looking at the well-being of people, not only access, functional access to services and facilities.
And that's why the word inclusivity in this topic is so important, because you can build something, but it doesn't mean that it's built for everybody. That was really helpful, Sarah, and moves us on to the next point, which is, look, you've worked on so many projects, all of you, but it's really hard. Sometimes you'll see something, you know, it's not quite right, and you say, oh, somebody should do something about that. But you two are somebody. You two have actually done things about it. So how do we do this? How do we put our thinking and ideas into actual progress and create positive change? Henk, I'm going to start with you, because you've done lots of this. Over the past 5 years, your organization has advocated for change. Can you talk to us a little bit about the European Declaration on Cycling, what this means and why it's so significant?
Yeah, well, I'm happy to talk about that, because it's we are very proud of that achievement that we achieved together with some members of the European Parliament, members of the European Council, and the cycling industry in Europe. But maybe before all this, one disclosure is that we have over many years cooperated with AREP. AREP has supported over the years our gatherings of cities and regions for cyclists, for which we are very grateful and which we appreciate very much. So there is a relationship between our organization and AREP already. About the European Declaration, it's so momentous because it was signed in April last year by the European Commission, by the European Parliament, and by the European Council, which is actually, for those outside Europe, that's the three branches of the EU government, if you like. What the declaration does is putting cycling at the heart of European mobility or transport policy, if you like. It prioritizes cycling and walking over other modes of transport in urban contexts. 450 cities around Europe need to come up with a sustainable urban mobility plan, abbreviated SUMP. We love acronyms. In those sustainable urban mobility plans, cycling and public transport need to be prioritized. So it's not even about a level playing field, it's about prioritization. That's one. Second is I didn't yet talk about inclusion and inclusiveness, but of course there are many more people who cannot drive a car than there are people who cannot cycle or learn how to cycle. When we think about children, people without driver's licenses, people who don't have access to a car for economic reasons. So that is actually a much bigger group, whereas we often get the argument that, yes, but my, you know, the whataboutism about there's always an example of somebody who cannot cycle. And there are certain categories of people for whom it is indeed very, very challenging. But look at a society like Japan, where actually many more women than men cycle, because women have different mobility patterns. Men go from A to B. Women travel, and there's a lot of research about this, from A to B to C to D to E to F and then back to A, because they pick up children, they take care of relatives, they do grocery shopping, etc. So it's a very different need. Anyway, back to the European Declaration. It calls for investment in infrastructure, investment in cycling policies, a lot of focus on road safety, as I already talked about before, but also about industry, supply chains. During the pandemic, there were suddenly no bicycles available. in Europe, focus on multimodal, the connection between cycling and public transport, for instance. A bicycle is it's very good to getting you from door to door, but it's not good for really longer distances, beyond, say, 10 or 15 kilometers. So there you need a combination between cycling and public transport, adequate bicycle parking at stations, or the possibility to take the bike on the train, share bike systems on both ends of the journey. So at the railway stations, at bus stops, have share bikes available. Cycling tourism. There's a lot of there's a big trend towards more active, more sustainable, more domestic tourism, where cycling tourism, of course, fits in very well. And on top of that, helps to fight over tourism, like in particular some cities in Europe are suffering from. And finally, the declaration goes into data collection, because we feel, and policymakers feel, we do not know enough. About cycling patterns, about why do people cycle, from where to where do they cycle. We don't even know where the existing infrastructure is. So we are running a big project now for the EU to try to make a Europe-wide inventory of the existing infrastructure, because you need to know what you have before you know what you need to build. So really, we see that the declaration is almost a year ago now, it was adopted, that it's trickling down into different policy areas and getting being mainstreamed in general EU policy.
Amazing. And we talk a lot on this podcast about collecting good data and being able to measure things to make great decisions. So it's good to see that theme continue. Sarah, you have worked on so many projects and particularly around promoting healthy and active cities. And you have a real focus on children, which I love, because you can definitely tell a city that has been developed with children in mind as a parent and that hasn't. And you've worked also on a number of transport projects in Africa before you joined Arup. So, can you just share? There's a lot going on there. Can you share a couple of examples of the work that you have done and also the impact that it's made?
Yeah, sure. As I mentioned before joining Arup, I've worked for 15 years, more or less, with the UN and development banks. And in Africa, in particular, when I started my work with UN Habitat, that was like almost 20 years ago, I was in the transport unit of the infrastructure branch of UN Habitat. And I was involved in a very interesting project. At that time, active mobility was called non-motorized transport. it was a kind of pioneering visionary project on how to promote NMT or non-motorized transport, so that active mobility in across Africa, Ethiopia, and Uganda. And my initial focus was in particular on informal settlements in Kenya, in particular in Nairobi, because I mean Nairobi faced many challenges, but in relation to mobility, there are many challenges related to limited infrastructure, of course, safety concerns, and also, as we discussed before, kind of there are deep rooted social norms, where I mean, using biking or walking is mainly done by the poor people. So that's a huge, a cultural issue that, of course, needs to address. Also, at that time, when I was working there, the transport conversation globally was mainly focusing on rural transportation. Not much. There was not a focus on cities and cities transportation, in particular when we're talking about Africa. So everything was about rural development, not much about urban development at that time. So, long story short, in Nairobi, I mainly work on a project in an informal settlement, Kibera, which is a huge informal settlement in Nairobi. And there we were trying to promote the use of bicycles, but not necessarily only for commuting, because they use it anyway, to commute to work, they walk or bike, people living in Kibera. Or they use the matatu, the public transport there. But what we try to do there is to promote the use of cargo bikes, for commercial purposes. So what we did, we work with a US-based NGO. They spend quite a lot of time with us in Nairobi, and we set up a workshop for youth people to basically design and build cargo bicycles that they were also then producing and also selling. So that was a very nice project because it was not just about improving mobility, but also actually using mobility as a way for promoting economic inclusion, to empower youth, and to to improve, of course, accessibility to economic opportunities as well. So that's kind of one project I did in Africa. And then another project, which is an Arup project, which has also a focus in Africa. I was not directly involved in the design of that project, so I don't want to take any credit for that. But is an immersive virtual reality experience that Arup developed with the Transformative Urban Mobility Initiative. It's called TUMI. And basically, this initiative was launched at the last World Urban Forum in Cairo. And when I was there, I experienced and was really moved when I tried the experience, because basically the name of the project is Three Continents, Three Journeys. And basically it allows the user using the VR to really step into the shoes of different individuals which are navigating urban mobility challenges. Particularly one is in Kenya, in Nairobi. And it is basically you see the experience of a guy on a wheelchair who is trying to take a matatu, as I said, these kind of small buses that are in Nairobi, in Kenya. And you can see the challenges this guy is on a wheelchair is facing to access bus services and to go to work. The other experience is in São Paulo, where you can see an elderly person that is also affected by Alzheimer's. That is navigating the complexity of public transport in São Paulo, trying to go and collect their child, the nephew, going to the market, and you get lost at the end. So it's very moving because you can see the person there. You can really, create a connection with that person. And the last one is in London, and it's basically a woman who is cycling home after dark, crossing a real park in London, which is really dark. It's not like fake. You can see the park. And it's scary because, I think the tools like this, I wanted to mention this tool because as we talked before, it's not just about infrastructure. It's really about awareness, social behavior, social norms. So how can we create a transport system, if we don't put ourselves on that a transport system that is inclusive, if we don't put ourselves into the shoes of the majority of the users. So if we only design transport system for one prototype kind of user, which is wealthy, has good mobility, we are going to exclude the majority of the population. So tools like this really help to create this empathy, the connection, this understanding of the needs of different users.
Yeah, and understanding those needs has to come from information from partners, which sort of moves us on to our next and the big part of the podcast that I love, which is the power of partnership. Nobody can do this on their own. And so who do we partner with and what can we get from that to make us more powerful? And we know that partnership is so important to ensuring that our transport systems work for everybody. So Henk, let's talk about the power of partnership. Can you give me a little bit of insight into what partnership means for you?
Cycling and walking are par excellence a local phenomena. People cycle around the place where they live. Maybe they do it on holiday, but it's a local thing. People care about the quality of cycling close to where they live or where they go to school. Can my children cycle to school safely? Can I reach the grocery store without ending up in a pothole? Or, as Sarah said, after dark, do I feel safe using my bicycle? And then we're not talking about road safety there, but we're talking about personal safety. Doesn't want my bicycle get stolen when I leave it at the station or at the library. So that's local. So therefore, it's a bit of a challenge to try to advocate for cycling at the level of the EU or the UN. because that's very, very far removed from the cyclists, from our members, because in the end, our member associations, they have people as their members. So we are twice or thrice removed from the grassroots. Nevertheless, the fact is that at the UN, at the EU, decisions are being taken that actually affect the daily cycling of those people in the streets and in the towns where they live. So how to make that connection? Well, one is, of course, through our organization, through our members and their members, we have our relationship to the grassroots, and their concerns travel up through the system to us, so we can voice them at the highest political level. But a more concrete example was when we went to the COP climate conference in Glasgow a couple of years ago. We were there, of course. We are official observer at the climate conference. We were there, dressed to the nines in the negotiating room, but for security reasons, we were not allowed to take our bicycles into the exhibition area, into the venue. And I don't think this is a secret, but at COP conferences, there are huge booths from car manufacturers, fossil fuel manufacturers, who actually were allowed to bring cars into the venue to showcase in their booths. So we had an issue, a challenge with visibility. There was a declaration being discussed about the contribution of the transport sector to decarbonization. It didn't mention cycling. It didn't mention public transport. It only mentioned electrical vehicles, self-driving vehicles, rechargeable vehicles, flying vehicles, etc. So actually what we did, we were there inside arguing this is not credible if you don't include public transport and active modes. But then outside the conference, because nobody could see that we were representing cycling, right? Because we were walking. But outside the venue, the local cycling activists had formed a kind of a picket line. So all the ministers, dignitaries, and officials, before entering the venue, they had to pass these people with placards arguing for more and better cycling. So when they later on the inside met us in the negotiating room, they knew actually what we were on about. So that was a great connection between, the corridors of power and the street, if you like. So that's the kind of partnership you need. We need both, we are the advocates or the lobbyists, but we also need the activists. And then, of course, we have not only partnerships with Arup, but with a number of other organizations which work in the same area. We have a good relationship with the European cycling industry, which supports us, and with in the NGO world, we are a member of lots of coalitions with other sustainable modes, the Marrakesh Partnership, the Slow Cat. We are close to Polis and all that kind of organizations.
Amazing. So definitely a power and partnership there. I love that visual of all of these cyclists doing, like going against some of the politicians, just to give that visual. Sara, look, you've talked about so many projects already. So obviously the power of partnership is so important to you. Can you talk a little bit about what it means at Arup and maybe an example of the power of partnership?
Yeah, sure. I think, partnership in particular right now is needed more than ever. And not only because not one single organization can actually achieve alone inclusive and inclusive mobility, active mobility. So of course it's a complex ecosystem. So there is the need to bring together different organizations, starting from grassroots organization. But also because of course now more than ever there is kind of also limited resources to do that, and there is a need to kind of change people's mindset and can also lobby for the importance of promoting active mobility, not only for the environment, which we know it can dramatically reduce air pollution and improve the well-being, but also, yeah, for the mental, physical well-being of people. So it's very important to bring together also advocacy groups that really help to change the existing conversation that is should not be only about electric vehicles, because they're not solving the problem, right? Because they are vehicles and they kill people anyway. So it's not that if you have more vehicles in the city, the problem is solved. Maybe you reduce a bit the impact in relation to the environment. At the same time, you create the additional impact in relation to use of resources. So, I mean, it's a complex topic and it's very important. So to bring together different organizations to address that. At Arrow, we have many strategic partners we work with, from C40, Resilient Cities Network, the Green Building Council. So we work across the board and partner with strategic organizations to really trying to push the agenda together and to complement our efforts, complement our expertise and capabilities. One partnership I'm particularly I was involved now, this kind of came to an end as a partnership, is the Real Play Coalition, which brought together AROP together with the LEGO Foundation, National Geographic, UNICEF, and IKEA. And we've been running this coalition for almost 5 years with the vision and the idea to promote play and movement and exploration for children and for, you know, the broader communities in cities. So we developed different design guidelines on how to create playful cities that are more active cities, and not only for children, but for everyone, because we know that in addition to be good for the physical and mental health, also play is important for developing many skills, social skills, emotional skills, cognitive skills, and there is a play crisis around the world. So that's a very interesting partnership I've been working with over the years, and now I'm also another important partnership I'm proud to be part of, and also that AROP is a founding member, is the Cities for Children Alliance, which is basically a collective of 30 plus organizations across the globe, from public sector, private sector, the UN. It's chaired by Save the Children, and is really bringing together many organizations which over the years they've been trying to push the child-friendly cities or youth-friendly agenda across the globe. And it's very powerful because that together is really possible to make our voice louder in terms of why it is important to have this approach, and also to share knowledge and tools, and so to have a bigger influence in the industry.
Okay, you have both inspired us, wowed us, given us all of this inspiration and excitement about some of the things that are going on globally. Here's what's going to happen. Our listeners are going to go, right, I want to get started. How do I do this? What do I do? Where can I start thinking about this? So this is the final part of our podcast, and we call it sort of the tips and the insights section. You've been doing this for a while. You would have learned a lot along the way. Can you share some wisdom that you have learned or some insights with our audience who might want to get started in this space that might help them on this journey? Henk, I'm going to start with you.
Well, what I said before about the relationship we had with the activists and us in the diplomatic negotiations, what I would say is if you are unhappy with your local situation, get active. Seek out your local cycling group, cycle association, whatever. Become a member, get engaged, but also. There is this, let's say, citizen power. I am thinking of, I don't know whether you know the concept of the BC bus, the bike bus. It started in Barcelona. It was not, there are so many cars. It's probably like Milan. People didn't feel it was safe to let their children cycle to school, but they wanted to have that, to let the children, and more important, the children themselves wanted to cycle to school. So what happened was that a bunch of parents got together And they organized the BC bus, the bicycle bus, where a group of me, 10, 20, 30 children, cycle the school route together with a couple of parents at the front and at the back to provide for safety and to see to it that no children go astray. And that worked. It's just if the authorities don't make the streets safe, see whether you can make the streets safe yourself. So now, a couple of years on, there are bicycle buses, groups of children cycling to different schools, different school routes all over Barcelona, and it's spreading to other cities. There's a famous one in Portland, Oregon, actually. And you see that when the authorities notice, they take the responsibility. So now it's not the parents, but it's actually the police, the traffic police, which goes with the children, which blocks the roads for the car traffic. And some of those roads, like is happening in other cities, may just be closed to motorized traffic between 7:30 and 8:30 in the morning. So take the initiative. Don't sit back home, complain, and wait for the authorities to do something. Of course, you have the power of the ballot box, but that's only every 4 or 5 years. But get engaged, do something. If you're not, if you're not happy with the situation, try to do something about it.
I love it. Great advice. Sarah, what is your tip or insight for our listeners?
I think they need to shift the conversation. The conversation shifting from looking at transport as an infrastructure problem, so to create more infrastructure, but shift the conversation on how create places actually where people feel happy, feel at home, feel connected with the place. Because there's so many, also bicycle lanes in cities around Italy, and I would never take them because they're, kind of isolated, they're not well connected. So to look at how to integrate those infrastructure that indeed are very important within the bigger urban environment, urban system, and do it in a way that not only take people from A to B, but actually create an environment where people feel happy, they feel safe, they really enjoy walking. So they don't have to compete with the cars or with the scooters in many cases. So that's kind of one advice. And then also to do that, the importance, as we said during the podcast, to engage with communities. Also, as Hank just said, be active, engage with community. And when you design a solution or a system, try to understand who is left out from this design. So try to really understand what are the different needs of the wider population in the city that need to be addressed and embedded into the design of the system. And to do that, of course, there is a need to dedicate time to understand the context and to engage and hear from different voices and perspectives. So I think that's kind of the tip or advice I would give.
Thank you. And sums up the importance of the word inclusivity again in this topic today. Sarah and Henk, thank you so much for joining us. I really feel like not only did we cover lots of topics, but we learned so much. And I like your advice, Henk. If you don't like it, just get up and do something about it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
That was such an inspiring conversation. One that really highlights the importance of designing with inclusion in mind right from the start. Whether we're planning a new transport system, redesigning a city space, or simply rethinking how people move through their communities, it's clear that inclusive design isn't just a nice to have, it's essential. What also stood out to me was the reminder that real change doesn't just come from big institutions or policies. It often starts with individuals, people like you and me coming together, sharing our voices and working towards a common goal. When we listen to diverse perspectives and design for equity, we really can create cities that are not only more sustainable, but also safer, more accessible, and more empowering for everyone. In our next episode, I'll be asking Matt Blacker, Program Manager, Climate Services at Climate Change Cook Islands for the Office of the Prime Minister, and Karen Barnes, Arup's Risk and Resilience Associate in San Francisco, this question. How are island nations pioneering climate solution. If you like this episode, don't forget to leave us a review and subscribe to Sustainable Forces on your favorite streaming service.